This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters. Our guest this morning is Peter Asmus, freelance journalist and author of a newly published book titled Reaping the Wind, How Mechanical Wizards, Visionaries, and Profiteers Helped Shape Our Energy Future. Peter is here to tell us about the past and future of using the wind to help meet our energy needs. Peter, what led you to write your book, Reaping the Wind?
Well, I've sort of fell into energy issues by accident. I was a freelance journalist, and I was starting to write about environmental issues, and I just sort of accidentally got hired on a whim to cover a battle over a nuclear power plant in my own community, which was Sacramento. It was called Rancho Seco, and it turned out to be the first nuclear power plant ever shut down by citizen vote. And then after we shut down the nuclear reactor, we started looking for solutions to our energy supply problems right in the community, and that's when the proposal came forth with wind turbines. And when I first saw the wind turbines at the Altamont Pass in California, I just was very intrigued by them. I actually thought they were sculptures or something, and I had no idea that these things actually generated electricity, and so it just sort of piqued my curiosity, and I just began to sort of start researching wind power, and the more I learned about it, the more interesting it became to me, just the idea that you could transfer, you know, something like invisible like the wind into something like electricity, and to me that was just such an intriguing idea. And that sort of started it. I started on this book in about 1991, so it took me, about 8 or 9 years to finish. I mean, I wasn't working on it through that whole time, but that's kind of how it all started.
How important is wind energy right now as a source of power?
Well, I would say it's really the single most. It should be our number one supply choice right now for a couple of reasons. One is the entire West is in this dire supply shortage, and power prices are just astronomical. And right now, wind power probably is the cheapest power supply choice we have. I mean, the other nice thing about wind power is there's no fuel cost. So no matter what happens to oil prices, natural gas prices, and all those things, something like wind power, you know that the price is going to stay the same. And right now, the new wind turbines, which are, you know, very sophisticated, large machines, can generate electricity for about 4 to 6 cents. The prices people have been paying for electricity have been as high as 30 cents, even as high as a dollar per kilowatt hour during the current supply crunch. So one thing is it's economical, and the second reason is concerns about global climate change. I mean, it seems like every week we get new reports confirming how the icebergs are melting. The insurance industry is claiming billions of dollars of losses because of rising sea levels. So right now, unfortunately, because of the supply shortage, we're actually running our dirtiest stuff more often. So I would argue that, one, just to meet our supply needs, and two, because of global climate change, that wind power should really be our top supply choice in America as well as the rest of the world.
How did the modern wind energy industry get started?
Well, wind power has actually been with us for a long, long time. Sailboats are basically, you know, using the wind for transportation. And wind turbines, I think one of the most interesting facts is that some of the first windmills in England were built in response to monopolies on water power. There, the king and the church would control power supply by controlling the water monopolies, and a few sort of renegades put up windmills saying the wind was free. But what really made the industry what it is today was in California, under Jerry Brown in the 70s, in response to the last energy crisis we had, there were some laws that set up incentives for wind and other renewable resources. And, of course, there were a lot of tax credits that eventually got a bad name, but they did basically sort of jumpstart the wind power industry. So California is sort of, under that time, sort of started the wind power you know, the sort of modern industry. But since then, you know, wind turbines are going up, obviously, throughout the country, including in the Pacific Northwest. But it was really these tax credits in California that kind of jump-started the whole modern wind industry.
What were some of the notable failures or challenges when the modern wind energy industry was first being developed?
Well, some of the problems were, there were a lot of problems. A lot of these wind machines just literally blew up in the early days. I mean, people, the federal government had a program which basically started out with real big machines, because the idea was, a lot of these machines were developed by people who worked in the aerospace industry and for military contracts, and of course, you know, bigger is better was sort of the idea. But those big machines had all kinds of problems. Then what happened in California is the private industry with the tax credits started out with much smaller machines, but some of those machines were so small and lightweight that they blew up too. So what sort of happened over time is that we had to really learn about the wind, how it impacts technology at the small level, and gradually the turbines now have gotten bigger and bigger. So the biggest irony is that the size of a wind turbine today, which can be as large as 1.5 megawatts, are the same size as the machines the federal government originally built. But what happened was this learning curve about just how the wind impacts a machine. I mean, if you think about it, we're putting this machinery in regions that have the worst weather in the world. I mean, the most wind. I mean, the wind is a very destructive force. So it's taken a long time to sort of learn how to design the machine to withstand the wind. And now we finally have gotten to that point where today the machines, it's wind power is the fastest growing power source in the world and has been for each of the last 10 years. So this technology is really taking off. So obviously the technology is working.
How did the early wind energy entrepreneurs go about finding the best sites for wind?
Well, that was, you're not going to have a good, well-operating wind turbine unless you have good wind. And what happened in the early days is there are actually maps of what they call the wind resource. And so meteorologists and other people would take measurements of wind, and you could sort of identify general areas where there was a lot of wind. But there's a lot of tricks. A lot of the early machines, people didn't realize that if you stuff too many wind turbines in one particular area, you can actually block the wind. You know, certain wind turbines might block the wind that would normally go to another wind turbine. So at one level, you have to do sort of a macro analysis of just areas where there's good wind. But when you're actually siting individual turbines, you need to even pay attention to trees and rocks in the environment. You can actually develop things called wind caves, which are areas where the wind just stops. And obviously, you wouldn't want to put a wind turbine there. So there's been a pretty sophisticated science that's evolved over the last 20 years where nowadays, people are much more careful in terms of siting, you know, what is the optimal amount of wind turbines in a certain area. Make sure you put them in areas that don't block the wind from other wind turbines. And so it's become a pretty sophisticated science.
How did the early entrepreneurs get the rights to wind energy?
Well, that was the whole kind of bizarre concept, wind rights. People have, you know, rights to gas and other fuels, but with wind it's kind of a little bit strange because it's invisible. You know, you sometimes wonder, you know, how could you count on the wind being there? But, you know, when you actually measure wind over a period of time, it's actually fairly consistent. What happened in the early days is the people would contract, usually with ranchers, and this happens today as well, where you basically give the person who owns the property royalties based on their wind rights. And these are sort of negotiated contracts. And I guess, you know, it's sort of like, I think a general average is somewhere around 5% or, you know, somewhere between 2 and 5% of the income that's generated from the wind will flow back to the landowners, which are typically ranchers. And so what's nice about this is in places like the Midwest, where a lot of wind power is going in now, a lot of farmers have been struggling with their traditional farming operations. But once you integrate some wind turbines into their fields, they can continue doing the cattle grazing and growing the crops they've always done, but they get all of this extra revenue now from their wind rights. And a lot of farmers now actually are the biggest supporters for wind power because they see this as a way of sort of revitalizing rural communities and allowing the people to maintain their farms and their old way of living, but now they have sort of a new revenue source, plus they're generating clean electricity for the community.
Could you say some more about the tax breaks that were given to wind energy in the early 70s? You mentioned that it was good for jump-starting the industry, but also said that they were given a bad name. Why was that?
Yeah, that's probably the most controversial aspect of wind farms. At one point, they were called tax farms because sort of the wind tax credits were sort of the last of the great American tax shelters. There was a lot of sort of scams where people put up machines that never worked. And on one hand, you could say that was a really bad public policy. On the other hand, there were so many problems with power plants like nuclear reactors where ratepayers were, you know, obviously in the Northwest, you had one of the largest bond defaults and stuff because nuclear power plants cost so much money and ratepayers usually had to absorb those costs. So on one hand, the tax credits sort of got a lot of private people to invest their money to facilitate the development of technology. And so, ordinary taxpayers, we weren't taxed for that. There were certain people who used their wealth to put in tax shelters, and that helped finance some of these activities. There's a lot of people who say that those tax credits were the wrong approach. Now we actually still have a tax credit for wind power, but it just goes towards the actual electricity generated by the plants. In the old days, there was more of an investment tax credit. Now, I've had experts tell me, though, that when the technology is at such a young state, you just need to get some investment. If you would have used a production tax credit from the beginning, all these companies would have never survived because their wind turbines needed a while to work out the bugs. So it's a very complicated thing. Whether it was good or bad is, at this point, you could make good arguments on both sides. I suppose, on the other hand, it was a way to jumpstart the industry. I would say that today, in today's market, a production tax credit makes a lot more sense because we no longer need, we're not no longer at that stage of prototypes. I mean, we now have commercial machines and operations. But it did paint a picture, the tax credits. There are people today who still don't believe wind turbines work, basically because of the bad name that came from those original tax credits.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Peter Asmus, freelance journalist and author of Reaping the Wind. Our topic is the past and future of using the wind to help meet our energy needs. Overall, what has happened to the wind companies that were started back in the 70s and 80s?
Well, most of them have gone under. Probably the most famous one, which is is explored in detail in my book, is Kennetec, which at one point used to be called U.S. Wind Power, then became Kennetec, and at one point was the largest wind developer in the world. But there was a series of things. Some of it was poor managerial decisions by the company itself. There was the advent of deregulation, which in the short term ended up killing a number of wind projects, and a lot of those were in the Northwest, and a lot of those projects, when they didn't go forward, sort of led to the demise to Kennetec. But they were one of the biggest companies, and they had a lot of institutional investors behind them. There was a whole long list of smaller companies that eventually went under. I mean, right now in America, we really have only one major wind company left. It used to be called Zond and was actually bought out by this big power company named Enron. There are a few other companies, but in terms of manufacturers. It's one of the only companies that still manufactures wind turbines. Now, those are what we call utility large-scale wind turbines. The good news here in America is that actually there are a number of companies that build small wind turbines, and these are turbines you could install at your own house. And in that area, there are a lot more companies. And in fact, it's one of the few renewable technologies that Americans dominate in terms of the global market. About 60 to 70% of the small wind turbines manufactured in the world are manufactured in the U.S. And, you know, a lot of these wind turbines are going to developing nations that don't have grids yet, and often they're paired with solar photovoltaic systems. But, you know, there's really only one major manufacturer left, and I would, you know, at one point there were at least 20. So obviously there's been a lot of companies that have gone under.
What do you see for the future of those the larger wind companies? Do you think that some more are likely to develop or not?
You know, that's a hard one to say. There are a lot of European manufacturers. Now, the Danes have sort of, a lot of the even wind turbines that were put in the ground in California were manufactured by other companies. It was the Danes that sort of emerged as the main manufacturers of wind turbines, and one of the reasons the Danish were more successful is they built heavier machines. Americans, we've always been sort of wanting to develop the lightest, the most cost-effective, the cheapest, and we've always built machines that are kind of lighter weight, and because of that, they tended to have some problems breaking down in the wind. So I would say it's, the wind market now is growing like gangbusters all around the world. Of course, the key question is with the Bush administration, are we going, you know, if there's some clear policy set out saying that America wants to develop a lot more wind turbines, maybe then we can see some more manufacturers. I mean, there are a lot of people that were employed by these wind companies that are still in America. They're still working sort of in the wind industry in a variety of professions. So I would say the key is really policy. Now, the Department of Energy under Clinton did set a goal of 5% of our electricity coming from wind by the year 2020. And if, it's hard to say if Bush would follow through on that, although the one thing I would say is Bush does like wind power. Texas now is one of the biggest states in wind power, although he seems to be focused on natural gas and oil exploration, there may be a chance where Bush may even set some, you know, or encourage wind power. And if that's the case, we might see some other companies coming up with their own machines.
California was initially a leader in wind energy, but now has been overtaken by Germany. Why do you think that happened?
Well, I think the main reason it happened was that Europe is so much more concerned about global climate change. And what happened in Germany really had no wind industry about 5 or 6 years ago. Denmark was always the country that had a lot of wind. But then what happened was Germany, as well as a lot of these other countries in Europe, started setting actual targets for renewable energy, about how much of their power would come from renewable energy. And Germany suddenly, they also gave preferred rates for clean power, you know, prices that were really, really lucrative in terms of a wind developer's perspective. So within like something like 5 years, Germany went from under 100 megawatts of wind to overtake America and is now the leading country in terms of wind. And interestingly enough, it's not like Germany has a lot of wind. It just shows that, you know, you can have the resource, but the most important thing are policies. And in Germany now, the wind industry has emerged as a heavily unionized industry. It's viewed as economic development, so it's not viewed as a fringe environmental technology. It's viewed as sort of an integral part of the whole electricity supply equation. They need clean power. It's one of the cheapest sources of clean power, and it can develop jobs in rural areas. So it's viewed very positively in Germany.
While the wind provides so-called clean energy, there are some environmental trade-offs. For example, how about the issue that's come up of wind turbines killing birds? How big is that problem?
Yeah, that's been I deal with that quite a bit in my book, because I am a bird watcher myself, and so the more I learned about wind energy, and then I learned about the bird issue, it sort of put me in a quandary. But the more I learn about it, the interesting thing was is that the earliest data that came out about the problem with birds and wind turbines came from the Altamont Pass, which just happens to be an area where one of the largest nesting populations of golden eagles in the world is located. And when people put in the wind farms, no one even thought about the bird issue. I mean, there's the old saying, you know, eye as sharp as an eagle. No one sort of anticipated that these birds would be running into the wind turbines. But there was a study done in the early 90s that verified that there were a number of golden eagles being killed, and then that kind of, I mean, that study actually ended up contributing to a number of wind farms being killed, particularly in the Pacific Northwest. But more you examine the issue, you started finding out that there were real estate interests and pro-nuclear people that were sort of twisting the facts in order to kill wind turbines. For one, because maybe they were trying to argue that instead we need more nuclear power, or two, they were worried that wind farms might impact their real estate values. So nowadays, there's been a lot of scientists who've looked at the issue, and they've sort of figured out ways to minimize bird strikes. For one, today's wind turbines are far larger than the old machines. For every, for example, you know, you probably put only in one wind turbine, where in the old days, in the 80s, you'd put in 15 or 10 to generate the same amount of electricity. The new wind turbines are much slower moving. They're bigger. The birds can see them. The main problem, the main wind turbine that was a problem, was a Kennetec machine, which was very small turbine with very fast moving blades. Some experts did a study and showed that virtually all the birds they found killed in the Altamont Pass happened to be with this one particular design, which is no longer being used. So I'm still, the Altamont Pass, there is still a level of bird kills there that is of concern to some scientists, but they're also saying that there seems to be so many of the birds in the Altamont Pass, they can't even tell if really the overall population is declining. And there's even an argument, some say, that the wind farms preserve the open ranch land, that if you didn't have the wind farms there and it was developed, the habitat would be totally destroyed, and that might even have a bigger impact on the bird population. So there's a lot of conflicting data, but the main thing is that when there's a new wind project put in today, there's all kinds of studies done to ensure that they are not located near major bird nesting populations, and that the new turbines are a lot more bird-friendly than the original design.
What has been the reaction of local communities to wind farms located nearby?
Well, I think there's been a mixed reaction, particularly when they were first going in the ground. I think there was a lot more opposition from some people. I mean, in areas like the Pacific Northwest in particular, where there haven't been a lot of power plants sited historically, basically because you had this huge hydro system that provided the bulk of electricity. I think, you know, the one thing about wind turbines is they sometimes tend to be put in remote areas where people maybe don't want to see reminders of their electricity consumption. I mean, we Americans tend to not want to think about those things. I'm one of those. I mean, when I go to the beach near Santa Barbara, I don't want to be looking out at oil derricks. You know, I'd rather pretend that I don't want to see those, you know, signs of our energy use and consumption. So, I mean, and there are certain places where I would probably argue that it's not a good idea to put in a wind turbine if it's a particular pristine recreational area. But, I mean, nowadays a lot of the wind projects are really viewed favorably, particularly in the Midwest. I mean, I happen to think that the wind turbines look pretty neat. I know there's some people who don't agree with that, but for me, they're visually interesting. And these days, the machines look, you know, good. There were some old machines that, you know, maybe didn't look that great, but nowadays, most of the machines, they are real sleek. They're, you know, they kind of look like sculptures to me, kind of kinetic sculptures. And I know there are people who share that view. There are also people who think that, you know, they're ugly and stuff like that. But I guess if, you know, you had to choose between a big, huge nuclear power plant or a big coal plant and a wind turbine, you know, generally speaking, I would always pick the wind turbine over those kinds of options.
What role do you see wind energy playing in the future? What are your predictions?
Well, I think that, I mean, sort of when I describe my book, I tell people my sort of bottom line description is I believe that wind power is the key to our long-term sustainability. And if we blow it with wind power, if we don't take advantage of wind power today, I believe we really are doomed. I mean, we have this energy supply crunch. We have fossil fuel prices going up. We keep hearing more evidence of global climate change and all kinds of negative impacts. I think it's fairly irresponsible to not invest in all renewable energy sources right now. Now, wind power is the cheapest source, but I don't think that it's the only answer. I think we need solar power. We need, you know, we need energy efficiency. We need all kinds of clean power options. But wind power right now is the fastest growing power source. Large wind turbines, small wind turbines, you know, they can help the developing world. They can help the West meet its current supply crunch. Another great thing is that there are no fuel costs, so there is price certainty with wind power. You don't have to worry about OPEC. You don't have to worry about, you know, people drilling for more natural gas. The fuel is there. So I really believe that wind power is the key. I think we need to do a lot of other things, but if we don't take advantage of wind power now, I really do believe we're going to be in big trouble.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
And thank you for having me.
We have just been speaking with Peter Asmus, author of Reaping the Wind, How Mechanical Wizards, Visionaries, and Profiteers Help Shape Our Energy Future, a book recently published by Island Press. For more information, check on the web at www.awea.org. Again, that's www.awea.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week.